So, thank you. It's a great honour to be here. Without more ado, I will begin talking about the catastrophe speech. And the first thing is what is a catastrophe speech? And why do we need to have them in the lexicon of speech writing? Well, a catastrophe is an overwhelming, unforeseen event that is deemed to be a threat to the authority of the state and therefore the authority of the political leadership of the state. And it is of such a kind of overwhelming threat that it must be this catastrophe must be responded to immediately. And what would be the aim, if you think, what's the principal aims of doing such a speech? The first thing, from a speechwriter's point of view, is to reassert the political authority of the government and of the leader. And secondly, obviously, to restore order and calm. So a catastrophe is an event that shocks the nation. Something like 9/11, the fire at Notre Dame, the Manchester suicide bombing, the Bataclan attack in Paris, even like the Challenger explosion, or the assassination of a national political figure like John F. Kennedy. So there is almost like an immediate need, an immediate response that has to be delivered by the leader. The joke is never let a crisis go to waste. So it's a great opportunity too. Now, just to be clear about it, catastrophes are singular events. We might think probably in this room, if I had a show of hands, that Brexit was a catastrophe. But Brexit is not a catastrophe speech. And neither are hurricanes or climate change or very complicated, because they are messy, inconclusive events, and you cannot fashion a single pivotal response. So that's the difference. Now, the pitfalls and the prizes of a catastrophe speech. I'm sure if you worked as a professional speechwriter, you craft a speech, your man or woman delivers it, generally to an unenthusiastic audience. But in a catastrophe, the world turns to you. They are queuing up and waiting to listen to you. And in that sense, it is the most dangerous and risky speech a politician can ever give, because the world is listening. And they will judge you either as the right person for the job, the natural leader of the nation, or a kind of tin-eared human android who's completely got it wrong, who deserves to be booted out at the next cabinet meeting by his rivals. So, but given the nature of this catastrophe, giving the speech is often unavoidable. The first thing about a catastrophe speech to realise is it has to be delivered within a dynamic environment. You're not going to know how many people died. You're not going to know whether the attackers have been caught. You have to do it in a sort of time frame, because time is your enemy. In our current era, because of the iPhone, anything that's a catastrophe in society, any kind of attack, like the attack, if you think of the terrorist attack on London Bridge, just outside the attack on Parliament, elements of that attack will be caught by civilians, in a sense, on their iPhones. And that will be picked up by 24-hour news outlets, and it will be echoed and echoed and echoed. So you have a choice. You have a choice of delivering the catastrophe speech and seeking to shape the reaction to the narrative, or if you don't do anything, the chaos of the internet and those 24 hours, they will write the narrative for you. So the longer that you delay, then the more chaotic, irresponsive, weak the government and central authority will appear to be. So I'm going to show you an exemplar catastrophe speech. But before I do that, I want to just point out four things that you should look at. One is look for timing. Look for framing. People actually underwrite this, particularly if you work in a bureaucracy. The way in which the person appears, the activity in which they're doing, the stage on which they appear to deliver this is a very crucial underwritten element. The other element is the effectiveness. What is actually saying, what impact? Yeah, it's different from affectiveness. But the content of the speech, what it appears to do, then there is the affectiveness, which means the emotion. Do I actually believe this person? Is this sincere? When you think recently, those who follow British politics, Boris Johnson goes on a press opportunity to an NHS hospital and a father of a sick child begins to shout and scream in front of the cameras. That was not a very good, you know, press opportunity. So you have to be careful here. So I think, if this first slide, the catastrophe I'm speaking about began in the early hours of the 31st of August, 1997, just 3 miles away in this city, at a bridge under the Seine, Ponte della Alma, with the events surrounding the death of Princess Diana. News of that accident began to reach. The accident happened at 12 a.m. on, on a Sunday morning, and she died at 3 a.m. Maybe we'll just look at the speech now, and afterwards we can go over it. Will this start now, Gav?
She was a wonderful and a warm human being. Though her own life was often sadly touched by tragedy, she touched the lives of so many others in Britain throughout the world with joy and with comfort. How many times shall we remember her in how many different ways? With the sick, the dying, with children, with the needy. When with just a look or a gesture that spoke so much more than words, she would reveal to all of us the depth of her compassion and her humanity. You know how difficult things were for her from time to time. I'm sure we can only guess at, but the people everywhere, not just here in Britain, everywhere, they kept faith with Princess Diana. They liked her, they loved her. They regarded her as one of the people. She was the people's princess. And that's how she will stay, how she will remain. In our hearts and in our memories, forever.
Even at this distance, he was still brilliant. Now let's look at the context in which that happened. So, in May of 1997, after 18 years of Conservative rule, a newly elected Labour government came into power under Tony Blair. Now, he did actually have a big majority, but it was still an untested government. In Britain, you have a universally hostile Conservative press. So this was, in a sense, the first catastrophic challenge to Tony Blair's government. As I was saying earlier, He The accident happened at 12 o'clock UK time, and she was declared dead at 3 o'clock. By about 2 o'clock, news had filtered through the British Embassy in Paris, gone back to Downing Street. Blair, who later on, once he grew wealthy and more covetous, you know, spent lots of time in Berlusconi's villa, but luckily, on this night, he was in his constituency in Sedgefield, a humble industrial town 266 miles away from London. What had happened about, so 3 o'clock, he'd been woken up, and with his guide, his confidant and speechwriter, this man here, Alistair Campbell. So the two of them, in that moment, at 3 o'clock in the morning, began to, you know, face what should be done and what their response would be. The first overwhelming act of genius of the two of them was to realize the significance of this event. You think about it, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. This woman has died. You know that she's kind of famous, but how famous? What is the impact? And they then thought, this is the most important thing that Tony Blair could do at that moment. That when he appeared in public for the first time, he would respond and give the catastrophe speech. Around them, it had been a hard-fought election campaign. August, as in Europe, the rest of Europe, most of the government was away on holiday. The Downing Street switchboard was manned by one man and a dog. And then the world began to burst around them. So many people, when the news spread amongst the UK press corps, so many people called Downing Street that the actual system crashed. There was no one else in government to help. So it was Alistair Campbell and Blair, and they realised he had to, the most important thing that he had to do was work on the speech and deliver it in public at the very first media opportunity. So Campbell arranged through the Press Association, and this goes back to framing, that Tony Blair would do a walk-by interview on the way to Mass, church, at 10:30 on that Sunday morning. And that, again, was another act of genius. There's a phrase from Northern Ireland about getting your retaliation in first. They weren't to know it, because it's always easy in hindsight to think, oh, this is going to happen. But most British TV shows dropped all their programming and went live. So if you get your retaliation in first, they are going to play you again and again and again. So anyway, that's what they organised. Blair's election agent, the British government at that moment probably consisted of three people. Blair, Campbell and the election agent, who was told to put up a metal barrier on the way into church to hold back the press. Obviously news, I don't know, I wasn't part of the press corps, but those journalists sort of must have got up at 4 or 5 and drove 266 miles, which is about a four to five hour drive to get there. And that's why you see so few microphones. If you think now, there would be like hundreds. The main other thing is, of course, is they didn't wait. They didn't like wait for a bureaucratic huddle. They didn't do it by committee. They realized instantly that they had to craft this together. So Blair was in his kitchen of a very humble house, and him and Campbell shut themselves off from the rest of government. Again, that was quite an astute strategic decision. Blair didn't phone up this, he didn't do that, he didn't use his powers as Prime Minister, he concentrated on the speech. How do I know this? Because Alistair Campbell told me it personally. So it's authentic. Blair's technique was to have lots of free floating paragraphs. That's the sort of, it wasn't a kind of order, it wasn't lined up. Going back to what I was talking about, effectiveness. The idea obviously is to emote and to convey that emotion to the audience. So what he wasn't going to do is he wasn't going to have a script. This had to be delivered off the cuff. If you look at the, well, I'll talk about the effectiveness, and if you remember the delivery of the speech, his voice breaks. He looks down obliquely at the camera, away from the camera. His voice catches. His opening phrase, if I have it here, "I feel like everyone else in our nation today, devastated." He is fusing himself with the nation. What a brilliant assertion of will. Most politicians, and if you're in a committee, you think, you can't say that. But he delivered it like they're bang. He has a sort of speechwriting technique. It's an epistrophe where he actually repeats, "In how many ways shall we remember her?" He also has a staccato rhythm, "the needy, the poor," etc. It's a very interesting sort of technique. But what he was doing, really, he's also delivering this effectiveness of the speech. And that's the phrase that we all remember, is "the people's princess." Now, this came obviously from Campbell, who was forever miffed that the most genius, if you've never worked as a tabloid press reporter, I'm sure you've not, and you would never wish to, but tabloid journalism and tabloid sub-editing is the compression of the world into headlines, into 72 points. What can we get on the front page? And pretty much the tabloid press and tabloid sub-editors in Britain are some of the best people in the world at this compression. But Campbell came up with that phrase, "the people's princess." I don't want to go into the details of Princess Diana was actually born into one of the wealthiest families in British history, etc., whatever it means. But that phrase absolutely, Blair could have trademarked that phrase. It was repeated endlessly. It could not be bettered by the entire British press corps. So in that moment, they're back and forth on the mobile phones to each other. The outside world is exploding all around them, and they are concentrating on the moment. Going back to the framing. So he appears to the nation. I remember it personally myself. I was down in my house. I had a house down on the coast. It's a sleepy Sunday morning. You start hearing it on the radio. You think, oh, wow. Turn on the TV. Bang. Yeah. Blair appears in the frame very early at 10:30 in a directed activity, going to church on this day of grief with his family. This is a humble man. Obviously, he's going to pray for the soul of Princess Diana. Isn't it? It looks like it. Yeah? The actual framing's perfect. Another way to do it would be if, like your political leader, you go to the hospital, something. But he's not just appearing for a press opportunity. It's a directed activity, which he does a walk by. The other thing about it is he doesn't do a press conference. That speech is 300 words long. He appears. He speaks for the nation. He doesn't answer questions saying, "Do you think it's MI6? He sort of appears. And what he does is he presents himself as the nation's prime minister. Like that, this little bit. He sums up our grief. When you think about the difficulty that they had together, what do they say about Princess Diana? She's gone through this kind of messy divorce. Whatever. I mean, what can you say that sums up, that binds up the wounds of the nation? That's a pretty tricky thing to do at 5 o'clock in the morning. And they came up with this very, very good speech. The framing, you know, was, I think, absolutely perfect. You looked at him with great sincerity. You thought that he was obviously going on with life, and he was. Michael Brunson, who was the ITN's political editor. A few words, Prime Minister, on what you're saying about this. But he did it so well. I think now we see the kind of catch and emotion in his voice. But at the time, obviously, there was this incredible shock across the British nation. This was the JFK moment. And so his language was incredibly appropriate for that. So, in many ways, I think this was an exemplar catastrophe speech. It was delivered immediately, yeah, at the first opportunity, in a dynamic environment where they really didn't know. I mean, they knew that she was dead. They didn't know. You would never know. Was this some sort of strange killing, an assassination, such and such? They concentrated on the main event, her death. The effectiveness. he summed up the nation as the nation's prime minister. Did you believe him? Could I have a show of hands? Did you believe him? You know who also believed him? The British people. Because his approval ratings went up to an unbelievable 93%. The Iraq war was to come. But but that was incredible. We're now going to look at what I think is a catastrophe speech that is connected to the same event. New Labour were famous for their media communication and their understanding and grasp. This is before we had social media. But there was another actor who turned out to be very infamous for their failure to grasp the media moment. And that was the royal household. Possibly by Blair's speech, we touched off this huge seminal moment in British history about Diana's mourning, a new form of grief. 2.5 billion people watched her funeral. So again, the vindication of Campbell and Blair's judgment at 3 o'clock in the morning in Sedgefield, that this was going to be an enormous event of significance. The royal family became involved in this strange row over refusing to lower the flags at half-mast at Buckingham Palace, because the sovereign flag is never... I mean, it was all sort of very strange. And eventually, the Queen gave a speech, a very rare direct speech to her subjects. Let's just watch it. And this was a week afterwards, after a long-running row in the Daily Mail. I think if you can see it. Can we see her? Not really.
First, I want to pay tribute to Diana myself. She was an exceptional and gifted human being. In good times and bad, she never lost her capacity to smile and laugh, nor to inspire others with her warmth and kindness. I admired and respected her for her energy and commitment to others, and especially for her devotion to her two boys. I, for one, believe there are lessons to be drawn from her life and from the extraordinary and moving reaction to her death. I share in your determination to cherish her memory. I hope that tomorrow we can all, wherever we are, join in expressing our grief at Diana's loss and gratitude for her all-too-short life. It is a chance to show to the whole world the British nation united in grief and respect.
Could anyone remember anything she's just said? there was a very, you can't really see it, but there's a very strange setup with the, it was on the Mall, and behind it there's sort of moving crowds behind her. I wouldn't say, with all due respect to Majesty, that it's the most emotive speech you could ever listen to. And I think it was everything that a catastrophe speech should not be. It was delayed. It wasn't particularly emotive. I don't think you didn't come away from that speech thinking, she's really upset about this woman. Which is, and now, the purpose, obviously, to doing this in a speech writing terms is, these catastrophes, these crises, are obviously opportunities too, by which the leadership asserts its control or reasserts its control. And that is absolutely, whether it's in business, but it's also part of the job of the state. Something bad happens, the leader, he or she, appears to say, chaos has not come again, order is restored, we are continuing on, we will absorb this, and we will go on with the great journey of the state. And so there is a great responsibility in that speech. What Blair did it with Diana was, it was a shock, it wasn't, in a sense, a threat to the state in terms of a terrorist threat, but it was a moment of kind of national crisis, which the new Labour government, if you want to say very cynically, self-interestedly, managed to capitalise upon. He expressed the will and political authority of his office, and huge numbers of people came round to the new Labour cause. They thought, yeah, this Tony Blair, he's like the best Prime Minister that we have. So it was, in 300 words, forged at 5 o'clock in the morning in a small kitchen in a small obscure town, one of the most powerful speeches delivered in the last 20 years, just at 300 words. Thanks very much. I can take any questions if anyone wants to...